Taking care not to tumble, Sandrine moved in the darkness back to the top of the staircase, found the door with her fingertips, and pounded. The door rattled in its frame, but did not give. "Open up, lady," she shouted. "Are you kidding? Open this door." She banged her fists against the unmoving wood, thinking that although the old woman undoubtedly did not speak English, she could hardly misunderstand what Sandrine was saying. When her fists began to hurt and her throat felt ragged, the strangeness of what had just happened opened before her. It was like a fairy tale. She had been duped, tricked, flummoxed. She had been trapped. The world had closed on her as a steel trap snapped shut on the leg of a bear. More to exhaust all her possibilities than because she imagined they possessed any actual substance, Sandrine turned carefully around, planted a hand on the earthen wall beside her, and began making her way down the stairs in the dark. They would lead to some spider-infested cellar, she knew, a foul-smelling hole where ugly, discarded things waited thug-like in the seamless dark to inflict injury upon anyone who entered their realm. She would grope her way from wall to wall, feeling for another door, for a high window, for any means to escape, knowing all the while that earthen cellars and shabby slum dwellings never have separate exits. Then she thought, why the fuck isn't Ballard here? Ballard was one hell of a tricky dude. He was full of little surprises. You could never really predict what he'd feel like doing, and he was a brilliant problem solver. That's what Ballard did for a living. He flew around the world mopping up other people's messes. The only reason Sandrine knew him at all was that Ballard had materialized in a New Jersey motel room where good old Dad, Loritz and Loy, had been dithering over the corpse of a slaughtered whore. Then caused the whore to vanish, the bloody sheets to vanish, and for all she knew, the motel to vanish too. 2 hours later, a shaken but sober Loritz and Loy reported the work in an immaculate and spotless Armani suit and Brioni tie. Sandrine had known the details of her father's vile little peccadillo for years. Also, and this quality meant that his presence would have been particularly valuable down in the Hag Witch's cellar, although Ballard may have looked as though he had never picked up anything heavier than a briefcase, he was, in fact, astonishingly strong, fast, and smart. If you were experiencing a little difficulty with a dragon, Ballard is the man for you. While meditating upon the all-round excellence of her longtime lover and wishing for him more with every fresh development of her thought, Sandrine had been continuing steadily on her way down the stairs. When she reached the part about the dragon, it came to her that she had been on these earthen stairs far longer than she had expected. Sandrine thought that she was now actually beneath the level of the cellars she had expected to enter. The fairy tale feeling came over her again, of being held captive in a world without rational rules and orders, subject to deep patterns unknown to or rejected in the daylit world. In a flash of insight, it came to her that this fairy tale world had much in common with her childhood. She felt tired and empty. Sandrine leaned a shoulder against the earthen wall, shuddered once, and realized she was crying only a moment before she fled into unconsciousness. In that same instant, she passed into an ongoing dream, as if she had wandered into the middle of a story, or more accurately, a point far closer to its ending. Much, maybe nearly everything of interest had already happened. Sandrine lay on a mess of filthy blankets at the bottom of a cage. The golden shower of shit, which is her way of referring to something like the safe word, if you're doing something dangerous. The golden shower of shit had sufficiently relaxed, it seemed, so as to permit the butchering of entire slabs of flesh from her body, for much of the meat from her right shoulder had been sliced away. The wound reported a dull, wavering ache that spoke of those wonderful objects, Ballard's narcotic painkillers. So close together with the narrow bars, she could extend only a hand, a wrist, an arm. In her case, an arm, a wrist, and a stump. The hand was absent from the arm Sandrine had slipped through the bars, and someone had cauterized the wounded wrist. The mystery of the missing hand led directly to cage number one, where a giant bug creature sat crammed in at an angle, filling nearly the whole of the cage, mewing softly, and trying to saw through the bars with its remaining mandible. It had broken the left one on the bars, but it was not giving up. It was a bug, and bugs don't quit. Sandrine was all but certain that when in possession of both mandibles, that is to say before capture, this huge thing had used them to saw off her hand, which it had then promptly devoured. The giant bugs were the scourge of the river tribes. However, the old ones, the real people, the cloud huggers, the tree spirits, the archaic sacred ones who spoke in birdsong and called themselves we, had so shaped the river and the forest, which had given them birth, that the meat of the giant bugs tasted exceptionally good. And a giant bug guilty of eating a person, or parts of a person, became by that act overwhelmingly delicious, like manna, like the food of paradise for human beings. We were feeding bits of Sandrine to the captured bug, that it might yield stupendous meals for the Sandrine and Ballard upstairs. Sandrine awakened, crying out in fear and horror, scattering tears she could not see. At stair 300, she passed through another spasm of weepy trembling, but soon conquered it and moved on. By the 400th stair, she was hearing faint carnival music and seeing sparkly light figments flit through the darkness like illuminated moths. Somewhere around stair 500, she realized that the numbers had become mixed up in her head and stopped counting. Many stairs later, Sandrine's thigh muscles reported serious aches, and her arms felt extraordinarily heavy. So did her head, which kept lolling forward to rest on her chest. Her stomach complained, and she said to herself, "Wish I had a nice big slice of sautéed giant bug right about now," and chuckled at how crazy she'd become in so short a time. Giant bug! Even good old Dad, old LL, who often respected sanity in others, but wished for none of it for himself, drew the line of dining on giant insects. And here came yet another proof of her deteriorating mental condition, that despite her steady progress deeper and deeper underground, Sandrine could almost sort of half persuade herself that the darkness before her seemed weirdly less dark than only a moment ago. This lunatic delusion clung to her step after step, worsening as she went. She said to herself, I'll hold up my hand, and if I think I see it, I'll know it's goodbye, real world. Pack old Tilly off the bedlam. She stopped moving, closed her eyes, and raised her hand before her face. Slowly, she opened her eyes and beheld her hand. Then she inhaled sharply, for it seemed to her that she could see, dimly and a long way down, the bottom of the stairs. A little rectangle of light burned away down there, and from it floated the luminous translucency that made it possible for her to see. Too shocked to cry, too relieved to insist on its impossibility, Sandrine moved slowly down the remaining steps to the rectangle of light. Its warmth heated the air, the steps, the walls, and Sandrine herself, who only now registered that for most of her journey, she had been half paralyzed by the chill leaking from the earth. As she drew nearer to the light, she could finally make out details of what lay beneath her. She thought she saw a strip of concrete, part of a wooden barrel, the bottom of a ladder lying on the ground. The intensity of the light surrounding these enigmatic objects shrank and dwindled them, hollowed them out, even as it drilled painfully into her eyes. Beneath her world existed another, its light a blinding dazzle. When Sandrine had come within 30 feet of the blazing underworld, her physical relationship to it mysteriously altered. It seemed she no longer stepped downward, but moved across a slanting plane that leveled almost imperceptibly off. The dirt walls on either side fell back and melted to ghostly gray air, to nothing solid, until all that remained was the residue of dust and grime plastered over Sandrine's white dress, her hands and her face, her hair. Heat reached her, the real heat of an incendiary sun, and human voices, and the clang and bang and underlying susurrus of machinery. She walked toward all of it, shading her eyes as she went. Through the simple opening before her, Sandrine moved, and the sun blazed down upon her, and her own moisture instantly soaked her filthy dress, and sweat turned the dirt in her hair to muddy trickles. She knew this place. The dazzling underworld was the world she had left. From beneath her shading hand, Sandrine took in the wide concrete apron, the equipment she had noticed all that harrowing time ago, and the equipment she had not, the men posturing for the benefit of other men, the sense of falsity and stagecraft, and the incipient swelling of a banal, unheard melody. The long yellow dock were on a sluggish umber tide. Three yachts slowly rocked, one of them the Sweet Delight. In a warm breeze that was not a breeze, a soil-looking scrap of paper flipped toward Sandrine over the concrete, at the last lifting off the ground to adhere to her leg. She bent down to peel it off and release it, and caught a strong, bitter whiff, unmistakably excremental, of the Amazon. The piece of paper was to cling to her leg, and there it hung until a second tug of Sandrine's dirty fingers, when she observed that she was gripping not a scrap of paper but a Polaroid, now a little besmudged by contact with her leg. When she raised it to her face, runnels of dirt obscured portions of the image. She brushed away much of the dirt, but could still make no sense of the photograph, which appeared to depict some pig-like animal. In consternation, she glanced to one side and found there, lounging against bollards and aping the idleness of degenerates and river louts, two of the men in shabby suits and worn-out hats who had pursued her into the slum. She straightened up in rage and terror, and to confirm what she already knew to be the case, looked to her other side and saw their companions. One of them waved to her. Sandrine's terror cooled before her perception that these guys had changed in some basic way. Maybe they weren't idle exactly, but these men were more relaxed, less predatory than they had been on the avenue into Manaus. One of the nodding, smiling men held his palm up before his face, and the man beside him leaned forward and grinned into his fist, as if shielding a sneeze. Grinning at her, the first man went through his meaningless mime act once again, lifting his left hand and staring into his palm. Grinning even more widely, he pointed at Sandrine and said, "Muna." The man beside him cracked up, "Muna, what a wit," then whistled an odd little four-note melody that might have been a bird call. Experimentally, Sandrine raised her left hand, regarded it, and realized that she was still gripping the dirty little Polaroid photograph of a pig. Those two idiots off to her left waved their hands in ecstasy. "She was doing the right thing, so Muna right back at you, buddy." She looked more closely at the Polaroid and saw that what it pictured was not actually a pig. The creature in the photo had a head and a torso, but little else. The eyes, nose, and ears were gone. A congeries of scars, like punctuation marks, like snakes, like words in an unknown language, decorated the torso. "I know what Muna means, and numb," thought Sandrine, and for a moment experienced a spasm of stunning, utterly sexual warmth before she fully understood what had been given her, that she recognized the man in the photo. The roar of oceans of storm-battered leaves filled her ears and caused her head to spin and wobble. Her fingers parted, and the Polaroid floated off in an artificial wind machine breeze that spun it around a couple of times before lifting it high above the port and winking it out of sight, lost in the bright, hard blue above the Sweet Delight. Sandrine found herself moving down the yellow length of the long dock. "Tough love," Ballard had said. "To be given and received, at the end perfectly repaid by that which she had perhaps glimpsed but never witnessed, the brutal, exalted, slow-moving force that had sometimes rustled the curtain, sometimes moved through this woman, her hair and body now dark with mud, had touched her between the legs. Sandrine, poor, profane, lost, deluded, most marvelously fated Sandrine." Thank you.